My approach has always been be a good human being. So be someone that's respected and build a great team. And so being part of being a good human being is doing your job really well, and building a great team is about the collective. I just remember saying, I've got something here that can make a real difference, because I had a process for building teams and building cultures, as we call it. Now, we didn't call it that back then.
No.
And so I had this sense of determination that I still have today, that still comes out in all of my work, like anything is possible.
What if the pressure to be constantly busy is actually preventing the very work that matters most? And what if building a great culture isn't about individual heroics, but about creating the conditions where teams can genuinely thrive? Well, today I'm catching up with my mate Colin Ellis. He's a 5-time best-selling author and a super practical culture consultant. And he spent decades helping organizations around the world rid themselves of what he calls toxic cultures. When we're recording this, we were sat in a traditional English pub in Winchester, and we're exploring the tension between delivering results and creating space for actually sustains us. And when I say sustains us, I mean all of us, not just Colin and I. Sustaining us both as individuals and as teams and organizations. So whether you're wrestling with how to build better teams or simply trying to find your own way forward, I reckon this conversation will remind you that sometimes you just need to stop overthinking and focus on the basics and go. Hi, I'm Digby Scott, and this is Dig Deeper, a podcast where I have conversations with depth that'll change the way you lead.
Colin Ellis. This is not awkward at all.
No, it's
we would often sit next to each other like this, so close.
Should we hold hands?
Maybe later. Let's finish this
bit. Why don't we start with, where are we right now? Let's just locate the listeners. Like, where are we actually sitting?
We are in the King Alfred pub in Winchester. It's in a little area of Winchester called Hyde, which is just around the corner from the remains of Hyde Abbey, which is where the remains of King Alfred were born. It's a very, very historic place.
It's a lot of history.
A lot of history. And this is a very traditional old pub. If you're listening to this, when you picture an English pub in your mind, this is it. They're opposite. They've got leather armchairs by the window with plants and ornate lighting. Beautiful.
It reminds me of a nana's living room.
Yeah.
I was saying before we jumped on, I was like, it just feels like every English pub feels like I'm going into my nana's living room and discovering all these knickknacks for the first time. It's like, look around, it's just all this eclectic stuff on the walls and, the history, it reeks of history.
It reeks of history. And just when you're walking around, it reeks of history. And of course, we're sat here with locally brewed pints as well.
Warm lager.
Cold.
Ale or something or other. Yeah, cheers, mate. Yeah. And those of you who don't know where Winchester is, it's about an hour southwest of London on the train.
Almost south-southwest.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's just north of Southampton.
Yeah. Now, we met, though, not in Winchester.
We did not.
Not in Liverpool, from where you're from. Not in Perth, where I'm from. Where did we meet? Melbourne.
It must have been Melbourne.
Yeah.
I was aware of you before then, as in, people had said, oh, you should talk to Digme, because we were part of business school. Mm-hmm. And we used to meet every quarter, was it?
Yep.
Every quarter. I remember someone definitely said to me, and I think it was in Sydney, what do you do? And I'm like, well, I really want to move into teamwork culture. And he's like, oh, you should meet this guy called Digby. But I never met you until Melbourne.
You know, my first memory of you, I didn't know you, was you dancing on the stage. At the end of the day, one of those conferences, and you got up on the stage and you just led the whole room of about 150 people in dance.
Yeah.
And singing. You remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
So that's my first impression of you.
Yeah. I'm amazed we're still friends.
you inspired me. I got up on stage.
Yeah, there you go.
We kind of slowly formed a friendship, I think. I don't think it was this immediate, like, right, we need to be hanging out with each other. But we were sort of in these similar worlds of leadership and culture and just fascinated by how humans come together and what happens when they do. I mean, I think that's when I think of your work, I think it, and that's one way to describe what you're about, is kind of the study of culture and humans. What led you into that space? Because your background is, you know, from what I know of it, the project management stuff was very much kind of your professional career, right? Before you got into this stuff. How did you end up being fascinated by humans collectively coming together?
So, you know, I flunked school. School wasn't for me. School was very individualistic. The times I was happiest in school was when I was doing team sports, right?
Yeah.
So I think that speaks to the kind of personality that I have. And I was fortunate enough, because in those days you could just get a job, and I got a job, and I found that when I started working, I really loved being part of a team. And I was working with a lot of kids, and we were kids my age in a machine room in a bank, and it was awesome. And so I had always had this interest in how teams form, how do you create successful teams. You know, the football team I support, Everton, were good in the mid 80s and then they weren't good. And I had this, but what was it that made them good? And today we would call it curiosity, but I was really interested. Yeah. So I used to write notes about what made teams good, and I got a job as a project manager. And, you know, I joke all the time, I was working for Trinity, which owned lots of regional newspapers, and they couldn't get any project managers for year 2000. So they basically asked staff. So I was working in telesales at the time. I remember my boss said to me, we want you to do the things you do. I was working with the Liverpool Echo. We want you to do those things, but in project management, because I didn't know what project management was. He said, I want you to build a really good team, because if we build a really good team, we'll get all of this kind of work done. And so that was really my fascination. And I used to observe other leaders, and I would write down, I still have a notebook that I write down what works, what doesn't. And so I found the project management world really, really suited me. Lots of variety, lots of different people, but also you need a really strong team to
get the job.
And I think that was one of the connections that we had. I feel that I always connect better with people who have, and I use this lightly, but kind of worked for a living. So you'd been in a job for, you know, 25 odd years, 30 years. And for you, it was the same. Because I remember, because you were in the recruitment world, and you, I remember talking to you about this once, and you said, if we hadn't worked as a team, there's no way we would have made our sale. That's similar for you, right?
That's right. Yeah. Actually, you're right. So that little story, in fact, happened not far from here. So I was in London. So I was working for a recruitment company called Michael Page. They were in financial recruitment. So I was recruiting people for the City of London. So accountants and, you know, finance types and all that for all the big investment banks and fund managers on it. It was super competitive. And we were the leading company in our space, which was recruiting accountants essentially. And well, I remember we had a sales target for the team of six of us of about £2 million or something. And the previous year it had been something like 1.2 was the target. And we're like, and management said, they said, oh yeah, well, we'll make it 2 million. Why not? Go for it.
Yeah, right? Management. What are they doing?
And we're like, that's impossible. We achieved the target in the year. We did 2.3 or something. I don't know what it was. So we smashed it. But I reckon one of the things that it wasn't just about individual brilliance. It was about this team of six of us. There was an incentive structure that was primarily based on the team target, not the individual target, you know. And so we, you know, I could work my ass off, but if the others didn't kind of play ball in terms of the team, we never would have made it. So we all decided, okay, well, the primary focus is the team achieving the target, not the individual achieving the target, where most of our competitors were incentivized by individual effort and individual achievement. But by coming together in the team, so we share a lot of intel and information, which our competitors, it would all be about, no, no, this is my client or my candidate or whatever. And we were like, no, it's ours. And that language became the norm. This is our target, our clients, our effort, as opposed to my. I never forgot that. I feel like I'm quite individualistic by nature, but there was something about how much easier it became, not just to achieve the target, but also to just made it enjoyable. Mm. Yeah, work was fun because it was about us.
Yeah. Right? Do you feel that there's still a lot of that thinking around? You know, I was talking only a couple of weeks ago about this, the difference between a team target and an individual target. An individual target will make someone single-minded on achieving that for themselves. And a team target is really all about how do we do it, right?
Yeah. Do I think there's great attention now, because if you zoom right out, I mean, our Western society seems to be a lot more about individualism and about what can I achieve and you can be anything and all this sort of stuff. And I think we're feeling the effects of that. So there's this kind of like, what do I want out of my life and what's my career about? And all that language is very much about the I, and I think it's been that way for some time. But I also hear people talking about, I really love being in a team and I love that sort of stuff. But I feel like there's a greater tension than perhaps there was before, because there's this expectation of individual achievement, of individual success. My life is the thing that matters, not our collective thing. And I see that in communities. I'm originally from Perth.
How did you get from Perth to London? What was that journey for you?
So I started my career as an accountant in one of those big firms. It was Arthur Anderson, who no longer
exists. You're the most unaccounting person I've ever met.
You should see me with your spreadsheet, man.
I love it.
That sounds like a threat. You should see me with this.
You watch out. I'm good. You know what I'm good with is I'm good with creating spreadsheets.
Yeah.
But I'm shit at maintaining them. Like, don't ask me to put the numbers in again and again and again. But you get me to create the formulas and take it from idea to something that people can use. I'm really good at that. I went into accounting, actually, in fact, the best side of accounting, auditing, right? I was an auditor, which is looking backwards.
He loved auditors.
But it was actually because my dad, he's an entrepreneurial sort of fella, and all his mates were as well. They all ran their own businesses. They were owner-operators of, you know, small businesses. Like, one of them had a bike shop and my dad had a general store in this little country town, and another one owned like a car parts shop and another one had a hardware store. And they all seemed to know about business, but they also had this sort of drive for being their own men, right? And so I thought, business, that sounds cool. What do you need to do to get in business? I don't know. How about a commerce degree? So I did a commerce degree. And then that led me into accounting, because that was the safe option. Like, if you wanted to, you know, get a job, accounting, you're never going to be out of work for that sort of stuff, which is probably a bit different today with AI and stuff. But, you know, in that firm, it was like, oh, I can do this auditing stuff. Yeah, I can do a spreadsheet. But actually, the thing I really like is training the new grads, recruiting the new grads, and doing all the marketing for the firm and all that sort of stuff, which wasn't what you got paid for. You got paid to do the numbers and fill in your timesheet, you know, doing billable work. So I realized pretty much within a couple of years that, no, I was much more about people. There was this realization, oh, no, I'm not going to be a partner. It's not my thing. But that sort of, I just followed my nose after that. You know, I went traveling. You know, after the 3 years I became chartered, then I went and worked and did Camp America.
Oh, cool.
And then I worked in Canada for a year on a ski resort, worked on a salmon fishing boat for a while, just to go and see what else was possible. Mm. And it wasn't about careers at that point. It was just about, let's just try different stuff.
Yeah.
See what happens. Came to London after that. I remember going to Ireland, went backpacking around Ireland for about a month, going like, I need to get my brain engaged after salmon fishing for I used my body, burned my body out, but I was ready to do something more professional again. I had this big old wish list. I created it when I was in Ireland. What do I want in a job? And I think this is important for anyone who's wondering about taking a different direction in their career, is to not define what the next role is, but to find the elements that you needed. So I went, I need to be dealing with professionals. I want it to be about people, not numbers. I want it to be fast-paced. I want it to be team-based. And I had all this list of things. And I got back to London not having any clue what that would be, but I ended up falling into recruitment after going to a bunch of recruitment agencies looking for some contract accounting work. And then I kept turning down all these contract jobs for being an accountant, because I was like, I don't want to do that, actually. I needed the money. And then I remember one of them exacerbated said to me, one of those recruiters said, you keep saying no. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
And I said, I want your job. Because I'd seen what they did and I had my list and I was like, ah, that's what I want to do next.
Yeah.
Was the recruitment. So that's how I fell into recruitment. Very long story about how I moved from this whole auditing accounting world. But the bridge was, I was recruiting accountants, so I knew the language.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was like, oh, no, this is fun.
And I think what strikes me there as well is how much our parents shape our future. My story is, similar but different.
Yeah, tell us.
Right, so in the sense that my dad was one of eight, they were very working class. So the traditional working class story is you've got 10 people, so eight kids, two parents in a three-bedroom house. They all share a bed. Their dad was brutal and he treated them that way. And so their goal was security, is get a safe, secure job. And so, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do in school. And dad was putting the pressure on, saying, you've got to pick something, you've got to pick something. And if you don't pick something, then be a plumber, a carpenter, electrician, you'll never be out of work.
Safe,
trust
safe
me,
option.
Safe.
Yeah.
And so, my parents were absolutely delighted when I got a job in a bank, because a bank was a safe, secure job, even though the family business is window cleaning, which is I've got so many stories about it, right? Window cleaning. I always joke to the kids about window cleaning and, you know, just how much hard work it is. Anyway, there was a sense of entrepreneurship, but not really.
It was more about security, by the
sense. It was more about security. It was more about bringing in money so you could live. And so when I got a job in a bank, parents were absolutely delighted. And so for me, you know, I wanted to be part of a team. I did this work. I was with a group of kids like me, and it was awesome. And then everything changed when I was 19. And you know, when I reflect on my life, there have been these moments in time, you know, what got me working for myself and all these kinds of things. I went away with my best mate at the time, Rowan. I did a post about him on LinkedIn recently. And we had an awesome time in Tenerife. And on that holiday, I read On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
So tell me about that. When you read it, what happened?
So I never read during school, except for the books I had to read, and then became curious about reading when I left school. And ever since, I've been a voracious reader. I love the escapism. I can't repeat a book because I love being in it in the moment. So people remember books. I just remember how it felt at the moment. And I read On the Road by Kerouac, and it gave me a sense of adventure that I'd never had before. You know, I was
How old were you?
19.
19.
Lower middle class. Yeah. I'd only ever holidayed in England and two brief sorties into Brittany in northern France, because that's as far as dad was willing to drive. Oh. We didn't have any money, so we always holidayed in England. And all of a sudden, reading Kerouac's journey from East Coast to West Coast.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had this life of hardship, and he was a writer and all of these kinds of things. Oh, I got completely lost in it. And I try and read it, if not every year, at least every other year.
That's amazing, isn't it? Because it's not a classic travel adventure story.
It's just in America.
And it's a wild ride. And the way he wrote that book, you know, I think pretty drug-fueled.
One piece of paper.
Sticky tape together, running through his typewriter, just stream of consciousness stuff, right? So there's something about that infected both of us, because I remember reading that. I was slightly older. I would have been maybe 24. I think I was in America. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, there's such a big world out there that I would discover, right? How has that influence stayed with you now, you know, all these years down the track?
Well, what I took from the book was this sense of opportunity and possibility. Is Kerouac very much in the book went with the flow, like literally that whole go with the flow, like a twig on the shoulders of a mighty stream, Del Griffith, Planes, Trains and Automobiles. But it was very much about that. So from wanting what my dad and my mom had kind of said, this is what you should have, all of a sudden I was like, yeah, never say no to an opportunity. And I always wanted better for myself. We call it ambition, but I had a desire to be better as a human and better at my job all of the time.
Where did that come from?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I'm sure people would make thousands in therapy with me on that. I think it was partly because I flunked school and I felt there's possibly some deep-rooted desire to prove myself. I think part of it's my personality. I have a lot of energy. You know, we were talking about age before. I'm 55 and 56 shortly. I feel like I've got so much to give.
Yeah, yeah. You're only halfway, man.
So I've got, you know, so many ideas and all of these kinds of things. And so I think it's partly my personality, partly my upbringing. My upbringing was very much, this is who we are. This is what we know. If you go outside of that, then there's lots of risk outside of that. And it's not that I had a bad upbringing. I had a great upbringing. Yeah. Like, my childhood was great, but it was very, this is what it is. There's an excitement I never wanted to turn my back on. And so every time I got to the point where, and every time I get to the point where I think things are conventional, now I'm older, I can ask myself the question, what's next, what's different. Whereas in the past, you know, I talk a lot about the fact that, you know, the goal is to live life with no regret.
Yeah.
Because you make a decision in the moment based on the information that you have at that time, and it's the right decision to make. Whether it continues to be so is always up for debate, and then you can make a different decision.
Yeah, with, as we get older, ideally with the benefit of wisdom.
100%, right? Of course, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I feel where I'm at in my life now, that decision like yours to make it a full life, not a half life.
Right.
That's what I call it.
That's cool, yeah.
And I reckon Kerouac fueled that. He was definitely a catalyst in that book for me. I look back at some of the decisions I've made, and in the dark times, we both, I think, feel this, I sometimes wonder, did I make the right call by following my path of, you know what? No, I'm going to do it my way, not the conventional way. And it's never been because I want to be different. It's not because I just want to follow the path of road less traveled because it's cooler or, you know, other people will think it's better. It's because that's where it's drawn me. Yeah. But sometimes, you know, I've just had a colleague I started my career with, you know, and he ended up becoming managing partner of one of the big consulting firms. He's just retired, you know, and I'm like, I'm not in a position where I can retire.
Right.
And there's this kind of little twinge of, could I have followed the safe path? And I think we both agree that's not us.
It's not us. And the conversation that we had, which we should share here, because I think if you're one of those people thinking of working for yourself, you know, I'm very British, obviously, but I spent 6 years in New Zealand. Again, don't want to turn down an opportunity. I was offered a job, so we moved as a family. Then 11 years in Melbourne because I wanted to experience the Australian lifestyle. Now I'm back in Britain and people are like, well, that's amazing. There must be loads of work. I'm like, I'm starting from scratch.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, five best-selling books and all of this kind of stuff and public speaking and clients in Europe. And this is great, but you're starting from scratch. And yet I look at guys who are here, my friends here who never left, who are retiring, they've all got houses. You know, my wife and I, we've got a little bit of money in the bank, not much, but we haven't owned our own house for 12 years. Mm-hmm. But it's that sense of adventure, which we talked about, that, you know, I can look back on, you know, talking to a friend and, you know, I said, have you had a good year? He said, oh yeah, I did a, you know, kind of mega sales this year. He said, but I follow you and I look at your life and I think, wow, look at all the places you go, look at all the people you work with. And it's very hard in those, on the black dog days, as I like to call it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Is to see that adventure. And that comparison is always, it's always there when you're not feeling on top
of your
game.
I think you named it. I think it's the comparison, right? And like, if we're playing the comparison game, then we're always looking sideways rather than ahead.
Right.
And I feel like that doesn't serve anyone. And the older I've got, the more like, I'm good. This is the choice I've made and it works for me. I'm curious about your take on, not necessarily the self-employment bit, but the, I think what we've both done is gone, what sort of life do I want and what do I want for my family, and taken some big risks. I know you have in the past, right?
Yeah.
And there's something about that deliberateness that I admire in you, right? Your call to come here after being pretty well positioned in Melbourne and, you know, lots of work on there and making the call to come here, I think feels like it was underpinned by, well, this is the life I want to create. There's something about aspiration and opportunity that lies elsewhere. Let's go where that is. But that doesn't come without risk. How do you think about risk? For anyone listening or watching, I feel like this is a core question. Like, we're in a world which is super uncertain. No one knows what's going to happen tomorrow. So you've got to make some calls, but there's also risk with calls. How do you process a decision and how do you think about the risk side of things?
I think I've always taken calculated risks. So let's take when I decided to work for myself, right?
Yeah. Which was how many years ago now?
I made the decision 12 years ago. I've actually been doing it for 10 years because the first 2 years were rubbish. Yeah. Absolutely rubbish.
Right, those
rubbish,
off.
Yeah, totally. Nobody knew me. Well, that was the point. We'd emigrated from New Zealand to Australia. It took me longer to get a job than I thought. And so we had a little bit of equity. We had a house in New Zealand, which we saw. We had a little bit of equity, which we were constantly drawing on, because we knew we would need some money for the first 3 months. I got a job, that was great. And then after 7 months, my boss quit, and I'd done a really good job. You know, I really had my job, which is change the culture of the team. And as a team, we'd done it, which was great. So I'd been recognized for that. And I was like, oh, I'll have a job, no worries. And my boss was like, I think you're well, they need people like you. And I interviewed for the job, and I was working as head of projects in an IT department, but it was all about the team and the culture. And they were like, we want someone who's good at technology. We don't want someone who's good at teamwork and team building. And I was crushed.
No doubt.
Because I was just like, I felt like that was my call. And, you know, here I was on this pathway to being a senior leader, CEO. Yeah. And I remember coming home to my wife and saying, I can't believe it. I felt like I was train on a track going north, and then all of a sudden the train got derailed. And I'd never thought about working for myself, never, ever thought about working for myself. And I said, we've got 4 months' rent and groceries in the bank. Mm-hmm. I think if I work for myself, I could make a go of this. I think I've got ideas that people would buy. We argued about it. I'm not going to lie. It was a lot of arguments. And
what was the base of the argument?
It was a massive. We had 2 young kids. We'd been in the country for 9 months.
So security.
We didn't know anybody.
Back to that.
Security. Yeah. 100% security. Also, no one in our families had ever worked for themselves. You know, my wife's, you know, her dad was an electrician in the shipyards in Liverpool. No role models. So no one really had ever taken any risks that way. And so we took a risk, and then we came within about 4 weeks of probably having to move back to the UK to live with our parents in our mid-40s.
And I can imagine Kerouac on your shoulder going, keep going, mate.
Yeah, keep going, jump on the train, keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it gets to the point, Digby, where you just have to go, yeah, okay, it's too much of a risk now. And you know, that's when I ended up taking a contract, getting an actual job, and then testing my ideas, testing my theories and going that way. Because what was it that led you to jump?
Quite different. So mine was, I can't do this anymore, the way I was working. So I burned out when I was 31. And anyone who's been following my podcast will know the story. But the short version of it is, I was running a recruitment company in New Zealand, in over my head in terms of, I had no idea how to run a business. So I was like, you know, I thought I did because my dad was a businessman, you know, and I was an accountant. Yeah. I know about numbers and I'm pretty good at recruitment. So, you know, all of these things don't add up to being a really effective leader of a business. And in fact, I wasn't playing to my strengths. So I was trying really hard, but I was running on adrenaline rather than wisdom. And so I was drinking 6 Red Bulls a day.
Wow.
And just to keep me going, I was waking at 3 a.m, going to the office because I couldn't sleep and be working. Stupid stuff. Anyway, so I hit the wall one night, woke up in tears, just going, can't do this anymore. And that led to a whole domino effect of changes. Moved back to Perth after having not lived there for ages. I think I've been away about 7 years or something at that stage. Newly married. Actually, before that, I took a bunch of time off, about 6 weeks. And I remember walking the Abel Tasman track, which is the top of the South Island, New Zealand. I took about 5 or 6 days off just to clear my head. And I just went solo hiking along the Abel Tasman track, which takes 3 or 4 days. And I had this epiphany on about the 4th day when I realized that I was much more about longer-term development of things, not recruitment, which is all very transactional, fast. And I was like, actually, I'm more about growing people than just getting people into jobs. And I'm about growing organizations and the leaders in those organizations, because in recruitment, you see the potential of the person, but you don't see the realization of that potential, right? And then I'm like, and I was a leader and I didn't have any support. And look what happened to me. So how do I support people? So it led me to, I've got to follow this path of development of people and cultures and organizations. I've got to follow that path. That was really clear. But then I think I'd been yearning. I think this is my early exposure to my dad's.
Yeah.
My dad and his colleagues, all self-determined people. You know, they're very much, I'm going to run my own business because it gives me autonomy. And I am, autonomy is strong in this one.
Yeah,
you just ask my partner or my kids, they'll be like, oh no, you don't box me in. And so there was this, is this the time to go and try working for myself? Didn't have a mortgage, didn't have commitments, didn't have kids. And so it was almost like a moving back to Perth, leaving that world of recruitment behind was like this complete clean slate. Yeah. It's like, all right, give it a go. What do you got to lose? And there wasn't much to lose because I felt like I'd lost a lot of me in the preceding years, a lot of my sense of confidence and identity. And yeah, I got swallowed up by that role. And so there was a rebuilding and it was like, why don't I go and do that? Listen to that inner voice about autonomy. Now's the time to do it. Now, my wife at the time, she's a doctor. She was earning pretty good money being a doctor in the hospital system. So the financial downside wasn't that much for me, which I'm really grateful for because it, like you, took a damn long time to earn money. I went to a market I hadn't been into for 7 years. People knew me as an auditor. So, and here I am becoming a leadership coach.
Yeah.
Like, what? And so it took me a good year to find my, not just my feet, but get some momentum on that. But it was smart to have a cushion, like a financial buffer, my ex-wife's income.
Mm.
But it was clearly the path. Like there was no way I was going to turn back from self-employment after that.
And are you determined at that point how you would be different? Kind of how are you going to stand out in the market? How am I going to be different? Did you focus on accountants? I'm interested
That's
in that.
A great question. Nope.
Hey, next question.
No, I think like I was in my early 30s and I think the drive was two things. Reclaim myself because I'd got lost and like, who the hell am I? What am I about? And rebuild my confidence. But then there was also this autonomy piece. It's like, just work for myself. It's just what I want to do.
Yeah.
I wasn't very strategic about, so how do I position myself differently? Interesting enough, though, back, it would have been the late 90s, and this is when executive coaching was a really new thing, and people didn't really know about it. And if they'd heard about it, they thought it was a remedial thing. We're going to bring you in to fix this person.
That's
they're
right.
Broken.
Yeah, they're broken, yeah.
And I think I was one of the first people in the Perth market to, I wasn't the only one that was doing that.
Mm.
I'd come across it through some people in the US and I was like, okay, I did some training and learned about it. And I think because I had nothing to lose, I just went for it. And maybe that's what distinguished me was this guy who's doing this different thing. And I was going for it pretty hard. So I remember getting interviewed by the local newspaper, the West Australian newspaper, and having a profile article.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
Within the first 18 months
of
being, I remember in this daggy suit and I was holding a clipboard.
Daggies.
That's what you did.
Daggy suit. That sounds so Australian. Mate. Daggy suit.
And I was holding a briefcase and a clipboard and all this. Like,
I want to see that. That's my night taken care of tonight. What are you looking for on there? You don't want to know.
Google ancient Digby Scott. And I think that's what made me stand out. So I didn't really have to, because it wasn't a competitive market. I was at the pointy end. That made it hard, but it also made it easy in a way because as you know what it's like when you do good work and people hear about you and they're going, oh, this thing that Digby's doing seems to be helpful. It was easy to get work after the initial lack of momentum. I've never really thought about that before, but I wouldn't have called myself strategic. I would have called myself opportunistic.
Yeah, yeah.
And not necessarily desperate, but determined.
Yeah,
I was like, this is the path. I don't care how long this takes. This is what I have to do. And the part of it was also that burnout period really got me thinking about, well, what do I want to make of my life? Is that Mary Oliver quote, you know, what do you want to do with your one wild and precious life, right? And it's like, you know, I didn't nearly die, but man, I was in a dark spot. And so there was this, I want to claim life and not just work life, but a whole integrated lifestyle that work became part of. And I'm still doing that today.
Yeah.
You know, I'm away now.
Yeah.
Here I am in the UK. I'm away for 10 weeks in total. I'm doing some work. I'm doing cool stuff with you. Lots of play. But that's been 25 plus years in the making.
Yeah.
This situation I'm in now. And I'm really grateful for, you know, it's funny because I think about that burnout. It's like I call it the early midlife crisis. And I'm really grateful it happened. You wouldn't wish upon anyone, but the darkest times are often where you kind of do the work.
That's right.
You know? And you've been there.
Yeah, and I like that. Yeah, and I love what you said about being determined, because when I didn't get any work and ended up with a contract, you know, we had the conversation because we had literally had nothing. My wife's like, is this the right thing to do?
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. I felt at that time, you know, my approach to project management had always been, and I, you know, when I headed up big project departments spending literally millions and millions of dollars, my approach has always been be a good human being. So be someone that's respected and build a great team. And so being part of being a good human being is doing your job really well, and building a great team is about the collective. I just remember saying, I've got something here that can make a real difference, because I had a process for building teams and building cultures, as we call it. Now, we didn't call it that back then.
No.
And so I had this sense of determination that I still have today, that still comes out in all of my work. Like, anything is possible, but there's structure. If you do these things in these ways at this time, and if you do these other things, you too can be really, really successful. And I remember early on in my career when I actually start, and I, you know, I bluffed my way into a speech, do a breakfast speech. There's a whole story about that, which I haven't got time for, but anyway.
Not surprised, he bluffed his way in. Right.
But I did, and when I think back, it's just like, well, that was just something I felt like I had to do to open a door. And people still say, you know, I was talking to someone last week, and they're like, oh, you know, we've been told you're the kind of person that says it how it is, which I am. Well, there's a negative connotation to that, like, you know, I'm somehow effing and jeffing and all of these, which I'm definitely not. The way that I sell it is that I use language that connects with the people that you want to do this work day in, day out. Because when you create that connection between, here's a concept that you've been told is difficult. Culture change is hard is a great example. But actually then when you use the language that they understand and you teach them the concept in a way that immediately lands, all of a sudden, oh, well, it's not complicated at all.
I think,
you know what I mean?
I would use, for what you do, is you free people up to make it not just easy, but effective because you demystify, right? You cut through. I mean, so yeah, cut through is good because you're just getting rid of the crap. You go, is it all it really is?
Yeah.
This is actually easier than you think, right? So you're kind of giving people permission just to do what it means to be good humans.
Yeah, you know, and the analogy I always use, which I'm just about to write about it, is signposts. So pre-1975, I think it was, here in the UK, there were no signposts except these really old, complicated ones. There were the old milestones that the Romans used to use, and they then repainted. And then all of a sudden we came up with a system of signage and everyone was like, now we know where we're going.
Yeah, how about that?
And it was almost overnight. And it's like that, you know, and you're the same with, I think, with demystifying what it means to be truly productive. I think people consider busyness, and this is, you talk about this, right? Is if we're busy, 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 we're productive, when it's almost the opposite of that, right?
I want to hear your story. You've told me this before, about your time when you were working for that power company in New Zealand. And you had an incredibly productive team, but it was never hurried. That's my understanding.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So tell us the story about that, because it's a rare example. If I look around and I look for organizations that have a highly productive culture that is unhurried, or even teams that are highly productive but are unhurried, it's really hard to find. Right. So you've done something different, though. What did you tell us about that?
And again, it was based on what I'd learned when I was in business myself. Up to that point, I used to write down the most productive teams were the one that make time for really hard work and play and all of these kinds of things that we recognize now as super, super important. We spent 2 days offsite as a team, agreeing how we would work together, and we would put the emphasis on making sure we got everything done during the day. But we did it in a way where we never panicked, we never flustered, because that's where you make bad decisions.
Yeah.
Now, this was, so 2008 was at a time probably before you were swamped with emails, although we had some rules around emails even back then.
What were those rules?
Yeah, so we talked about what was appropriate to copy someone into and what wasn't. So we made an agreement.
Brilliant, brilliant. And that minutiae, that detail is great.
You know, one of the other things I did, and this was in 2008, I used rules. So when I was on holiday, to send emails to trash. And I wrote about this 4 years ago. And the CFO read the book and he was like, it's life changing. I now come back to no emails. I was like, yeah, I was doing that like, you know, 14 years ago, whatever it was. And so what we ended up with, Digby, was a team that really valued productive work, but in the working day. And then on Friday, we would always kind of, that was the culture that we had. We would always go and have a drink together.
Did you ever feel like there was pressure from outside of the team for that, in particular that Friday thing, right? Like, what? How did you deal with that?
What, to have it or not have it?
Yeah, just any pressure that you felt from, you know, judging eyes.
There was always that because it was an engineering company. They had a no drink policy, so you couldn't drink on site, which was fine.
Fair enough.
But we saw it, you know, and I've written about it. I think you've written about it as well. Camaraderie. That was our sense of camaraderie. And from the outset, I said, it's not about the drink, which as a Brit, obviously, that's why they asked me to move to New Zealand.
Ironic. Yeah.
But it's not about the drink. It's about camaraderie. It's about learning. Yeah. And one of the program managers that kind of had a dotted line report to me, I met her recently and went to Ronnie Scott's jazz club in London. We had a great time. And we keep in touch because, you know, and she still says, I still say, it was the best team I was ever part of.
Yeah, you invested in the relationships, not just the work, right?
But we did things in a methodical way. We recognized that we had to put a shift in. We talked about what it meant to work hard but smart, even in 2008. And had an old peer who got in touch with me recently. He was like, you were always different. You were always different. I was like, in a good way. He was like, oh yeah, in a good way.
Yeah.
But I was doing things that were kind of frowned upon.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I used to read books in the office.
Yeah.
Business books. I'm not sat there reading Kerouac or, you know. So I used to read the Harvard Business Review, these kinds of things. And, you know, I was always looking to stretch myself to learn new things about how can we improve the way that we work together, which brought me to this point now where I have a specific way of helping teams to, you know, achieve their goals. But a lot of people still struggle with it. Was it something that you struggled with?
I still struggle with it. I think that's why I write a lot about Unhurried, because I'm trying to work it out for myself. Mm. Like I feel like there's this ethos that's been built into me, and perhaps it came from the early days with Arthur Andersen where we had to fill in timesheets of which was, you know, every 10 minutes you had to be accountable for what did you do in that 10 minutes and put on your timesheet. And so being productive meant being busy doing valuable work. And then valuable to me is the thing that I think we miss a lot of the time. So reading HBR, so where's the output from that going to be, right? No, aren't you supposed to be solving this problem right now? Whatever. And I reckon I still struggle with, at some level, that story that if I'm not doing something that's an output, you know, that's valuable and, you know, people can see that there's something that's been delivered as a result, where's the value in that? And I know intellectually that that is different. Obviously, reading is a really key part of that, or just sitting and connecting and talking is a key part of it. I know that intellectually, yet I think it's deeply ingrained in, well, certainly my psyche, but also I think for culturally.
In social cultures, it is.
It's something that I think we have to really consciously overcome. And yeah, we all know that using our brain to override a deeply limbic sense of I need to be seen to be valuable, that means being busy. That's really hard to overcome. What I think you did well in that story is you gave permission or created the conditions for people to feel like they had permission to not be busy, right? And I think that's the key.
Yeah.
I think the key is to really go, you know what? It's okay to do some reading or go out and have a drink because this is actually part of what we call work. You know, I think work we need to broaden out as a definition.
But I think, and this is, there are so many things that unite us, but I think one of the things that unites us is we have a central message that if we feel that we can get out into the world, which is a big, you know, it's a big ask, but if we get out into the world, that we can actually change the way that we think about these things. I can, you know, I want to rid the world of toxic cultures. What a great vision that is. And if I can educate people on how to build culture, then we never get, you want to rid the world of just unproductive, stupid decisions, right?
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I try to model that, but it's a systemic cultural thing. I mean, I think there is certainly plenty of stuff that we can do as individuals, yet I think for leaders in particular, I think someone like it was in your position in that company to be able to go, you know what? No, we don't have to do it all today. You know what? No, let's put in some rules about how we work. That's the leverage point where you've got leaders who are able to go, no, 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 I'm not going to value flat out busyness as the primary metric of success
here. Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're playing a longer game here. Yeah, and I think that's a really, really important message. Mm. Man, I'm feeling it.
I'm ready to go to work. Never mind. Spend the day in, or spend the rest of the day in the pub talking.
Or get some lunch. Yeah. So as we wrap this up, mate, so what have you been reminded of or learned through in this chat we've had?
It's always good to remember where you came from. And I don't mean as a way of dragging me back. It's always good to reflect, and the frustration sometimes that I feel here in restarting the practice, restarting the business, it's been a good reminder that actually I've been here before.
Yeah.
And it's now about finding a different avenue or a different street or a different road to take the message down. Also, I feel like it's deepened our connection.
Yeah, I agree. But
even though we're great mates.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like it's really strengthened that. And, you know, when I read everything about longevity of life, there's a lot about fitness, there's a lot about diet, but it's also around surrounding yourself with people who've been on a similar journey, who you can have understanding and empathy for, and you create these bonds that sustain you into later life. So that's what I've really taken from it. How about you?
I love what you just said, because I've been feeling it without words. It's just like, oh man, we've not actually ever done this level of depth 101.
No.
Yeah, in this sort of conversation. This has been awesome. So yes, thank you. You asked me a question about was I strategic when I set up my coaching practice years and years ago. And I think I've been reminded of sometimes you don't want to overthink strategy. Sometimes it's that pure determination that you need at a certain point where that's the thing that'll get you moving, right? It's the, and I see this in you having moved back to the UK. You know how to do this. You know how to reinvent yourself and get things moving and, you know, create a practice and all of that sort of stuff. And I think sometimes we can overthink what it means to get momentum.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to go hard with no kind of clever strategy. Just go. Maybe that's your strategy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And see what happens and learn and evolve from that. So yeah, that was a good reminder because I don't think I was super clever, but it worked.
Yeah.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, mate. This has been awesome.
Hang it
out. Thank you.
Hey, just a quick reflection before you take off. There's something that Colin and I talked about that's really sticking with me, and that's that shift in language. For example, from my target to our target, or from my client to our client. It's such a small change in language, but I reckon it transforms everything. How we show up, how we support each other, and ultimately how much we actually enjoy the work we're doing. And I reckon that's at the heart of what Colin's been banging on about for years now. In building great cultures isn't that complicated. It's about creating the conditions where people can be good humans and do good work together. But it requires leadership and leaders who are willing to give people permission to not be busy all the time and to invest in relationships and not just deliverables and to value camaraderie as much as productivity. And that takes courage and determination. As Colin reminded us, sometimes that matters more than having just a clever strategy. If this conversation got you thinking, please share it with someone else who needs to hear it. And if you haven't already, subscribe to Dig Deeper so you don't miss any future episodes. Thanks for listening. I'm Digby Scott, and this is Dig Deeper. See you soon.